Chapter 4, Uhura. It turns out that the hospital part isn't so bad. He gets a few minutes with a dermal regenerator for the bruises and a laser orthobiological restoration for the ribs. The whole thing only takes a couple of hours. The less enjoyable part comes later, when he has to look at his mother's strained expression through the holo screen they've hooked up in his overnight room and tell her that he's sorry for bothering her. "I opened the message during a ship meeting," she says. The audio feed was broadcasted in front of all of the highest-ranking crew. Jim nods sympathetically. "Don't you just hate it when your kid's rape interrupts a perfectly good meeting?" His mom sighs. "Don't get me wrong, I'm glad you sent the audio feed to me." Her voice goes hard. "We're going to make sure that director is put away for a very long time." Jim just nods again. "You're not going to say anything?"
"What do you want me to say?"
She frowns. "Why didn't you talk to someone about it instead of dealing with it by yourself? Were you trying to get yourself killed?"
"So what if I was?" Jim asks. "Everyone's been telling me my whole life that's what heroes do. Dad did it and you miss him," he thinks. "Sam did it and you miss him. Maybe that's what it takes for you to miss me."
Certainly people prefer a dead legend to a living mistake-making human being. His mom's face goes dark, and Jim changes the subject. "How are things in space?" She's not stupid. She knows he's deflecting. But apparently, she wants to talk about it just as little as Jim wants to, so she lets herself be distracted. She tells him about Jakku, the desert planet they just made first contact with, about the completely different method of engineering they employ, how she wants to integrate it in future starships. As she talks, he can see the obvious happiness in her eyes, in her gestures. She's found her home on this 5-year mission, and nothing is going to dampen that feeling of purpose, of fulfillment. Not even Jim's self-destruction can get her down. He promises himself that this is the last time he leans on her, forces her out of her home to come to his rescue. He's going to take care of the rest himself, whatever it ends up being. He's not going to bother her anymore when she's clearly content and in her element among the stars. Except, that is, to tell her,
"Mom, Frank's cheating on you."
"What?" she exclaims. "Why, what makes you say that?"
"You're going to be 5 years away in space, and Frank's just dandy with this plan? He's definitely cheating on you."
Mom relaxes, smiles, shakes her head. "Frank loves me. That's exactly why he's okay with it. True love means doing the best thing for the other person, even if it's difficult. In this case, it's Frank's loving me enough to let me go." Jim doesn't know anything about true love, or even if he believes it exists at all, but he's had plenty of people who loved him enough to let him go. True love, to Jim, is someone loving him enough to make him stay. In the end, Jim gets 2 days solitary confinement and a month added to his sentence. But Mr. Mortimer goes to jail for 20 years, so Jim considers it a win overall. Solitary confinement is a 6x4-foot room, covered in salmon pink tile, featuring absolutely nothing but a drain built into the center of the floor and a holovid camera in one corner of the ceiling. Jim takes one look at it and tries not to sound too anxious when he says,
"How am I going to get food?"
"We'll send your meals through there," the officer says, pointing to a small rectangular hatch in the wall. It's bolted from the inside. Then the officer leaves, the door sliding into place behind him, and it's just Jim in the little room. He leans against one tiled salmon pink wall and slides down into a sitting position and decides he's not going to let them see him freak out. He is James Tiberius Kirk. He has driven a car off a cliff. He has survived a genocide. He has defrocked a priest. He is not even hungry. He can survive 2 days alone in a little room.
He takes a deep breath and counts the 12,650 seconds until lunchtime. 12,650 seconds later, Jim is on his feet and glaring at the camera, and very much not panicking.
"Isn't it lunchtime yet?"
There is a pause, then a beep,
and then a tinny voice is projected into the little room.
It's only 10:40, Mr. Kirk.
Something cold and desperate claws at Jim's throat. No, it can't be. I counted...
You must have counted too fast, then,
says the voice, sounding bored and a little bit irritated. Jim slams his hand into the tile. How do I know you're not just screwing with my head? How do I know I can trust you?
You don't.
So Jim takes a shaky breath and recalculates and counts to 6,530, as slow as he possibly can. Is it lunchtime now? He asks when he finishes. There is no answer. Hello? He calls, the desperation returning to claw at his throat, at his stomach, at his heart. Is anyone there? The silence is deafening, blinding, suffocating. That's when Jim's legs decide they don't want to hold his weight anymore, and he sinks to the pink-tiled floor, his vision blurring at the edges. He keeps trying to take in breath, but the air isn't reaching his lungs. Oh, he realizes distantly. I'm having a panic attack. Please. His voice is so weak he can barely hear it. Anyone? In a moment of dazzling, brilliant fear, he knows they've forgotten about him. They've forgotten him, left him. He's going to die in this cold, tiny tiled room, curled up and trying to hold back tears. And he's not even hungry yet. He's gasping for breath now. He's dying. I don't want to die, Sam. God, help me, but I don't want to die. Sam, Erica, Tom, Natalie, Kevin, baby, Sam, help me. I don't want to die. I don't want to die. When he opens his eyes, there's an officer looking down at him, and she's not even naked, which is how Jim knows he isn't dead.
What?
He manages, which, okay, was trying to be a what happened, or maybe even a why yes, you can frisk me, officer. But he's going to give himself a partial credit for effort. You passed out, she tells him, and looks kind of angry about it. Or maybe concerned? Jim's seeing three of everything, so it's hard to tell. Do you have a medical condition you neglected to tell us about? Does Tarsus count as a medical condition? Jim wonders vaguely, watching the spots of colors dance in front of him. Sometimes it feels like it should. He carries Kodos around with him in every cell of his body and every thought in his head, like a cancer, like a time bomb. He knows it's only just a matter of time before it kills him. Mr. Kirk?
You didn't answer, Jim mumbles. I called, but no one answered.
This is solitary confinement, kid. It's supposed to be solitary to make you think about what you've done. We're not allowed to answer unless it's an emergency. Oh, Jim doesn't like the sound of that. Thinking is scary. As long as he doesn't think, he doesn't have to ask himself how much Kodos succeeded in his effort to own Jim, to make him over in Kodos' own image. However much he succeeded, it was too much. I'm scared, Jim thinks. I'm fine, he says. I thought you'd left me alone. Leave me alone. Did you think we would just forget about you? The officer asks. Yes. No, he scoffs. Get out. I don't need your help. Don't go, please don't go. Help me, help me, help me. She scowls, but gets to her feet and turns to leave. Wait, Jim says just before the door slides shut. She waits. He can't make the words come out. Just say it, he tells himself furiously. Say, I don't want to do this anymore. You can add more time to my sentence, but I can't do this. I can't. But that's the thing. This is punishment. Compensation. He went into that office knowing there would be a price to pay. Now that he's paying it, he can't just say no. Nothing has happened to him that he didn't deserve. She's still waiting. She looks kind of concerned now. He takes a breath and forcibly unclenches his hand and says, "Can I have some kind of food?" The officer stares back at him, confused, so Jim hurriedly adds, I won't eat it unless I have to, just, I need something, anything, please. Then the door is sliding shut and locking into place, and Jim swallows, feeling the panic returning, his heart pounding double time, screaming silence, screaming silence, screaming silence. And then, finally,
The hatch tilts open, and a single granola bar is sent into the little tiled room. To them, it means nothing. To him, it means a week of not dying if... when? If they forget about him. Jim curls up on the floor and clutches the granola bar for dear life. The problem isn't that solitary confinement makes Jim think. Jim always thinks. Couldn't turn off his brain if he wanted to. The problem is that solitary makes him remember. He remembers the way Sam's whole face would light up when he smiled, as if he had no worries at all, even on Tarsus. He remembers how Erica used to look at Sam, annoyed and helplessly affectionate and protective. He remembers how Natalie grew up faster than all of them, became a mother at 15, gave up her food, her sleep, her everything for baby, and never once regretted saving her. He remembers laughing with Tom until their stomachs hurt, although he can't for the life of him remember about what. He remembers, with crystalline clarity, he remembers everything Kevin was wise to forget. He remembers his private lessons with Kodos, lessons that ranged anywhere from fascinating to life-changing, because whatever else could be said about Kodos, and a lot could be said about Kodos, the man was undeniably brilliant. He remembers the day Kodos began teaching him economics, months before any hint of the oncoming famine, and Jim had slouched and sighed and spun his pencil through the lesson until Kodos had asked him what exactly he had against the subject. "It's useless and boring," Jim had replied, pouting. "I don't want to be an economist." "You will need to know the laws of economy if you wish to succeed in any area," Kodos had told him. "Everything is based upon the principles you will learn here."
"What do you mean?"
"Every interaction that occurs between people is, essentially, an exchange of goods and services. Take, for example, this interaction we are having right now. The colonists of Tarsus IV pay taxes to fund the schooling system under the assumption that investing in the education of you and your classmates as resources will eventually benefit them in return, when you contribute to the settlement and to the galaxy as a whole."
"Then, when you give me these private lessons..."
Kodos smiled. "I am investing in you specifically as a commodity that I am certain will eventually compensate me, specifically, for my efforts."
"But you'd still teach me even if I didn't, right?" Jim hedged.
"That's the law of economy. Of course I wouldn't."
At Jim's hurt expression, he explains.
"There's no need to be upset. It's nothing personal. This is simply a basic mechanism underlying all interactions and relationships. All of our decisions are, at their hearts, cost-benefit analysis. Even the most loving spouse will leave the relationship if his or her partner poses too much of a cost in contrast to the potential benefit. The more of the galaxy you experience, James, the more you will see this is true."
"People don't just leave their spouses. They love them."
"Yes, and love is a very valuable commodity. All feelings are. People will pay great prices, millions of credits, decades of their lives, to achieve certain feelings. Feeling honored and honorable, feeling that they belong. Athletes, for example, are paid exorbitant amounts for the service of making their fans feel part of something bigger than themselves. However, even the commodity of love cannot override the laws of economy. Why do you think marriages end when their sex lives are no longer satisfying? They still love each other, but as the requirements of services are no longer being met, the costs of the relationship outweighs the benefit."
It was beyond weird hearing the man Jim thought of as a father, even more than his actual father, talk about sex, especially so casually.
"Is that even love?" he asked.
"Love shouldn't be just another factor in the calculation. It's supposed to be something immutable, precious, everlasting. When you find the one, you'll just know. All that stuff. It's supposed to be forever." Perhaps the greatest love is between a parent and a child. And you are a testament to the fact that sometimes parents decide there is something more important than being with their child.
Jim hadn't responded, and Kodos had gone on gently.
Everything has a price. All humans spend their lives paying. What makes your cost-benefit analysis different, special, if you prefer, is how much you are willing to give for what you are liable to gain.
Jim didn't know, still doesn't know, how much of it he agrees with. But like everything else, he didn't have to agree for it to slowly take over his life. He just didn't disagree.
So, if everything has a price, Jim had said slowly, how do people pay for it all?
How will I pay for it all?
Kodos had always been good, secondly only to Sam, really, at reading the true questions behind Jim's questions. And this time was no exception. The governor had just brushed his fingers through Jim's hair, given him a smile he didn't understand until much later, and said,
"Don't worry, James. I'm certain you have plenty to give."
He remembers one night almost a year later when he was sneaking back into the house well past 2 a.m., drunk and stumbling and trying to remember the name he was shouting half an hour ago and how many tentacles were involved. He made it inside without being caught, only to be stopped in his tracks by the sight of his mom and Frank kissing in the doorway to the kitchen, the soft light highlighting her hair, his hand against her cheek. For all the other stuff Jim can say about Frank, and there is just so much Jim can say about Frank, he and Mom really do seem to love each other. At the same time, though, here they are, paying each other off in kisses and companionship and sex. So what is it? Is it love, or is it just another example of economics? Jim ends up going the long way around to his room, climbing up the side of the house and picking the lock on his own window. He half drags, half rolls himself into bed, and lies there wondering what will happen to their love when there's no recompense. What happens when they're, say, separated for 5 years on a Starfleet mission? Who sticks around when love can't pay up its side of the bargain? He remembers one night, 6 months before that, under the stars with the rest of the Tarsus kids, sitting around and talking about what they wanted to be when they grew up. Tom, Natalie, Kevin, Jim, and Baby, obviously, didn't know yet. Jim's career plans changed by the hour for his part. Erica, on the other hand, knew exactly what she wanted to do. Her eyes lit up as she explained why interspecies neurogenics was pretty much the coolest thing anyone could ever do for the world. How she was going to create a standard medical baseline with which all practitioners will be familiarized so that any species can travel to any planet and know they'll receive adequate care. Kevin stopped her 4 different times to ask her to explain things, and each time she patiently broke it down for her little brother. When Jim stopped her to explain stuff, just to be annoying, really, he was easily following what she was saying. She just scowled and thwacked him on the head and said, "Don't act dumber than you are. Someday you might start believing your own lie." Sam had equally specific career plans, but of an entirely different sort.
"I want to be a dad when I grow up," he told them, completely straight-faced.
Jim rolled his eyes.
"Yeah, okay, but what do you want to be?"
"That is what I want to be," Sam insisted. "I'll probably do something else, too, to make money or whatever. But I want to be a father. I just want to be there for someone whenever they need me. If I can do that, I'll be happy."
"Liar," Jim thinks. "Hypocrite. Liar. I needed you and you died. I hate you. I hate you. I hate you for leaving me. I hate you for being noble and dead, just like Dad. I wanted to save you, Sam. I tried to save you. I tried as hard as I could. I gave every commodity I had, but I...
He curls more tightly in on himself, the sob catching in his throat. Jim looks up blearily when dinner has passed through the hatch in the door. Has to blink a few times to remember where he is. Has to deliberately pry his hand away from the granola bar to take the tray. There are angry red marks where the wrapper cut into his palm. He settles down to eat, his thoughts still whirling like he's in 3 different places, or maybe 3 different times. All at once, like maybe he's gone insane and just hasn't realized it yet. He's so out of sorts that he's already unwrapped his tin of scrambled eggs and his cup of fruit and is halfway through unwrapping the next item when he realizes it isn't shaped like food. It's shaped like... He turns the book over. The Great Gatsby. It isn't the copy from the detention center library. He opens it up, finds a note in Miss Williams' distinct scrawl on the inside cover. For Jay, may you find a green light worthy of your aspiration. Immediately after hanging up with Jim, Winona places another call to the social worker at the Kirk Juvenile Detention Center. I need you to find out whether my son is considering suicide, she says when he asks what he can do for her. He frowns.
Did he say something to indicate he would be?
Yes, maybe. I don't know, she sighs. I don't have the time, she thinks, skills to figure it out myself. The social worker promises he'll bring it up, and he does, but he doesn't get anything useful out of Jim. He tells Winona 3 weeks later that Jim hasn't shown any suicidal behavior. Jim, for his part, doesn't really know whether or not he's suicidal. He's not going to kill himself. That much he found out the day he left home. But if his starship's autopilot failed during an evacuation, and someone had to pilot its collision course into the Narada, he would volunteer to be the one who stayed behind. That's a good thing, isn't it? Jim returns from solitary confinement to an empty cell, and the latest news that Nick got out of the detention center for good, that his mom came back and presented some new evidence. Jim translates that as lots of money, and got Nick out of there like she should have done in the first place. Without his larger-than-life roommate, Jim's cell becomes colder and lonelier. Just another little tiled room. But he had always known that Nick was too good for this place. Too good for people like Jim. So life goes on. A new director is trained in, but it hardly matters since all the kids, and most of the staff, answer to Jim. The social worker tries to subtly figure out if Jim is likely to commit honorable harikari on his own pencil. You know, the usual. His favorite part of juvie is still Miss Williams, especially when she assigns them literature analysis essays as part of an end-of-the-year project. Jim writes an essay comparing and contrasting Jay Gatsby and a plant, some of which is immature and purposefully exasperating. Jay Gatsby does not nurture himself via photosynthesis, some of which is legitimately perceptive. Plants, like Gatsby, are always reaching toward a light that's a lot prettier from far away than it is up close. And some of which are far too personal. Reaching toward the light is both why they are able to defy gravity and why they grow so crooked. When Jim gets released from prison after his extra month sentence, he nearly runs out of there, triumphant and hopeful and free, and isn't even off the center grounds before he realizes he has nowhere to go and stops dead in his tracks. Mom's in space. Frank is... Frank? If he's honest with himself, he hasn't really had a home to go back to since Sam died. He shivers, suddenly feeling cold and lost. Puts his hands in his pockets. Feels something made of paper. He pulls Miss Williams' letter out of his pocket. Takes a deep breath. Reads it. When he's finished, his fingers have left creases in the paper and his eyes are damp. He doesn't know the boy Miss Williams wrote this letter about. The boy Jim knows as a disappointment, a delinquent, a slut. The fact that she thinks he could be anything else hurts more than any of the insults and snide comments he's endured over the years. He crumples up the letter and throws it into the garbage dump on his way out of the George Kirk Detention Center. His mom had talked about space like it was her calling. Her life's purpose, like she was born to explore the final frontier. To Jim, it had all seemed like she was trying to justify to him why she was never around. He'd always loved the stars, of course, but he hadn't understood the powerful and intimate relationship she'd described. Until now. These days he looks up at the stars, and they're just as they've always been, perfect and distant and beautiful. But now there's something else, too. Like a voice he can't make out exactly, but knows is there. His calling his name. The great unknown. The open, endless, what could be tempting him. pulling him, whispering in his ears and filling his eyes like the sirens of the Odyssey, like nothing he's ever felt before. Whoa, he breathes. Turning 18 is kind of a revelation for Jim, because he can have sex legally, which is pretty cool. Or at least one less thing to get written up for, and as everyone knows, Jim's motto is, the less getting arrested, the better. Yes, he has gotten arrested 8 times since juvie. For vandalism, drug possession, forgery, disorderly conduct, indecent exposure, pyramid schemes. That one was just one big misunderstanding. Kind of. Breaking and entering, more disorderly conduct. But those were all necessary evils. Especially the indecent exposure. Getting arrested for having sex is definitely an unnecessary evil. Basically, now that he can technically stop lying about his age, not that he does, but he could if he wanted to, and Jim's all about choices. So yes, Jim has a lot of sex with every type of person in every type of position. For a while, he averages more than one person per day. Good times. But one thing he never does is get his companion's name wrong. This is partially because Jim makes a rule, which is bizarre in itself because he pretty much lives to break rules, but he has this one rule he adheres to with almost religious fervor, and that is, once the zippers are down, he only ever calls his hookups by pet names. Baby, darling, sweetheart, whatever. Sometimes he knows their real names, sometimes he doesn't, but once the action starts, they all become baby, so he never runs the risk of calling them someone they're not. After a lifetime of being called George, Jim decides it's better to make everyone anonymous than to make them over in the image of somebody else. Jim is an adult now, technically. And, like a proper adult, he gets a job. Or, well, jobs. He's smart and intuitive and can figure out what people want. Which ends up coming useful considering he is hired and fired. Sometimes he quits. From 17 jobs over 4 years. He works in a kitchen. It was worth the verbal abuse to learn that killer roux recipe. And the roux wasn't bad either. In a mechanic's garage, his longest running job at a whopping 3 months. At a circus. He's not allowed to talk about it because of the lawsuit, but he does occasionally drop the fact that he worked in a circus to pick people up in bars. Teaching 8th grade math, glasses, plus finally being able to grow a beard equals Jim looking like someone you'd trust your children with. Apparently the fake ID helps, too. As a dolphin trainer, he's still not quite sure how he got to California in the first place. A tennis instructor, long story. A nanny. The family loved him, but forced him to choose between them and his weed. Thanks, but no thanks, the man. A bus driver. It took 2 months for them to figure out that Jim never got his driver's license. Mailman, same. Waiter. Jim always got his food out earliest, possibly because he was banging the head cook, so the customers loved him, so his coworkers hated him, which was the end of that. Telemarketer, just turned into phone sex, and a handful of other short-term odd jobs. When those don't pay the bills, Jim can always do a little bit of illegal fighting, or more often, stripping, which he is actually great at. But since he finds he makes more credits doing... private performances, it inevitably just ends up being prostitution. It always comes back to prostitution. Prostitution is also what lands Jim back in juvie, but that's a whole different story. Jim still doesn't get why he keeps getting arrested for having sex. You meet a lot of interesting people in a job like that. Some good, some bad, some ugly. Mostly ugly, but Jim doesn't judge. But they all want the same thing. Which is not Jim. It's not that they don't want Jim, they definitely do, but what they're looking to get from their money is always something different, something nebulous and inexpressible. They want to feel in control, or wanted, or worshipped. They want Jim to become who they want him to be, and Jim is uniquely qualified to do just that. Sometimes he even believes his own lie. That's what makes Jim so good at what he does. One guy hired Jim for a whole night. And then just set a chessboard down on the hotel bed and asked for a game. Now, Jim knows charity when he sees it, and he doesn't like it one bit. So he did the obvious thing and got his revenge in the form of wiping the floor with the poor guy. So Jim had smirked and checkmated the guy in under 10 minutes. to which the guy had stared at Jim, and then at the board, and then back at Jim, and demanded another game. He'd hired Jim every Sunday night for 2 months to play chess. Which, yeah, eventually turned into chess and sax, and then into just sax. Jim wishes he could say he was surprised. That guy was still Jim's favorite customer by far. Chess was the best kind of foreplay. The point is, Jim actually has, you know, stuff. Responsibilities, people to do, things to see. So it's not like he can just pick up and go every time Tom freaks out over what Jim is coming to think as the annual Kodo sighting. Which, yes, he should not be making light of, because Tom actually thinks Kodos has returned from the dead every time. Actually freaks out. Every time. And every time, Jim has to ask himself what he would do if Kodos really were still alive. It leaves him raw and exhausted and desperate to run in the other direction. Every time. It goes like this. Jim and his club buddy is minding their own business, enjoying the weekly drugs bust, when Jim gets a message on his comm line from Tom. I found him. Jim takes one look at the message and wants to delete it. Or better yet, throw the pocket pad at the wall.
What are you looking at?
The police officer patting Jim down snaps. Nothing, Jim mutters, just as the pocket pad screen lights up with another message. He can hear the officer's teeth grind.
It's Kodos. He's alive.
Jim closes his eyes, willing the message away. He opens them, and it's still there. He sighs and types back. It's always Kodos. This time, Tom doesn't reply immediately. Jim watches the screen while the officer pats down his pant leg. Normally, having another humanoid on their knees in front of him would be turning Jim on, but he really couldn't care less at the moment.
This time it's for real, comes Tom's response. Sorry, I can't make it out right now.
There's an even longer pause before the next message.
You're clean, the officer says, looking annoyed.
Jim just nods absently. His pocket pad buzzes with another message. All it says is, please, JT.
Want, the officer fumes, is so important on that pad that you...
Jim puts his pocket pad away, takes a step forward, and pulls the officer into a tight hug. I'm sorry I made you feel neglected. Nothing is more important than you. Than us. He looks up at the man and bats his eyelashes. Let me prove it to you. The officer grimaces and pushes Jim away.
Just because you're not in possession of drugs doesn't mean I can't bring you in for contempt of the law. You get out of here while I'm in a good mood, kid.
Jim just smiles beatifically back, gives a jaunty wave, and makes his exit stage left, like the nice officer suggested. The smile slides off Jim's face as soon as he's turned away. When he gets out on the street, he glances over his shoulder to make sure nobody's watching, then takes the nice officer's keys out of his pocket, twirls them on one finger, whistling. Then he climbs into the parked police car and tears out of the place like a bat out of hell. Jim fires up the sirens, floors the gas for 9 hours straight, and manages to get to Tom's address at 5 o'clock in the morning. He parks across 3 parking spots. Hey, he stole a police car. He deserves to take some liberties. And somehow manages to stumble up the stairs to the 4th-floor apartment. He thinks he's going to have to pound on the door for 10 minutes at least. But he knocks once and the door swings open to Tom. 3 years older than Jim remembers him, but still wearing matching flannel pajamas.
You look terrible, says Tom.
Well, I was driving through the night for this loser friend of mine. Jim replies.
What's your excuse?
I haven't been sleeping too well either, Tom admits. Then he adds, with a gesture to himself and a self-deprecating grin Jim recognizes all too well, at least my face only looks half as bad as yours. And yep, that's about as much patience for niceties as Jim has right now. So he forgoes the whole nice-to-see-you-come-on-in nonsense and pulls Tom into a hug.
Tom squeezes back like Jim will disappear if he lets go.
After a good full minute, they separate, grinning dopely and pretending they don't see the wetness in each other's eyes. Tom ushers him inside and closes the door.
I can't tell you how good it is to see you, JT, he says in a low voice.
He also doesn't turn on the light, so Jim has to assume someone is sleeping.
It's good to see you too, Tom, he replies sincerely. I'm still going to kill you if your mystery man isn't Kodos, of course, but it is good to see you.
So Tom shows him the pictures.
It isn't Kodos. His knees almost buckle with the relief. Every single time. Tom looks at him questioningly, pleadingly. Jim just shakes his head. "Don't kill me," says Tom, giving him those big, miserable eyes. Well, I. And the thing is, no matter how irritated Jim is with Tom's paranoia, and Jim is very, very irritated at this point with Tom's paranoia, he knows that his friend actually believes he's seeing Kodos every single time, and is actually terrified every single time. And that's why Jim can't stay away. Idiot he is. Every single time. Not to mention the feeling of having someone actually rely on him, need him, even if Tom doesn't really need him. Well, Jim's not going to give that up. Jim sighs, the irritation flagging in favor of giving in to the relief and the exhaustion and the electric terror he had been keeping at bay since getting Tom's message. He collapses on Tom's couch with a groan and lets his limbs stretch out haphazardly. "Right now, I just want to sleep. I'll kill you in the morning. By the way, you didn't do anything illegal to get here, did you? Because if so, I don't know you," Tom says in a joking, overly serious voice. "I'm applying to PhD programs now, and let me tell you, the acceptance process is brutal. So all unworthy friends have to go." "PhD programs, huh? Well, la-dee-da. What area?" "Biochemistry research, with a focus on, He hesitates, then takes a breath and says, all in a rush, "Synthetic foods that can be locally replicated, digitally transferred, and preserved over a long period of time, so we never have another famine." Jim is speechless. "You know," his friend says awkwardly, obviously anxious for a response. "He does know." "Yeah, that's... Tom, that's amazing." Tom flushes and, predictably, changes the subject. "So, what have you been up to, JT?" "The usual, bouncing around odd jobs to keep myself from dying of starvation or boredom in between juvenile delinquent centers." Tom frowns. "Well, they seem to have been paying you well, at least," he says, eyeing Jim's designer jeans and authentic leather jacket. "Like what you see?" Jim waggles his eyebrows suggestively at Tom, who laughs. "I got these for my last modeling job. They let me keep the clothes."
"You know, that's really good to hear, because I was honestly starting to suspect that modeling was your code for porn."
"Well, the line between the two is, you know, blurry at best. But my modeling, I really just mean modeling."
Jim considers that, then amends. "This time, at least."
Tom doesn't laugh.
"Jim, I'm worried about you."
Jim throws an arm over his eyes.
"Oh, look, it's my favorite conversation."
"JT, I'm serious. You're too smart to get by on flipping burgers and porn starring and the occasional forged check."
He pauses, waiting for a reply. Jim doesn't even try to give him one.
"You've already been to juvenile detention twice, Jim. You should really meet my mom. You'd like her," Jim says. "Sometimes I'll see a blonde kid in the news who got shot in some gang fight or cut up and left on the side of the road because he hitchhiked with a stranger, and I have a heart attack. Until I'm sure it isn't you. The life you're living isn't... You guys can stay up all night worrying together." "Wow, that sounded really wrong. I changed my mind. You are not allowed to stay up all night worrying with my mother, Tom."
"I mean, it's a miracle that you haven't died from some exotic STD yet. I ask you, is there anything lamer than death by alien sperm? But you guys can totally bond over how you both watch the same TV shows and love Josh Groban.
What if you get put in the hospital? Who will I call? Am I on your emergency contact list? Do you even have an emergency contact list?"
"No, seriously, I think this might be the beginning of something beautiful here. I know you don't want to talk about what happened on Tar-
Yeah, no, we're not talking about that.
I know, really, I know. I just wish you'd talk to someone about what could-
But Jim doesn't hear the rest because he stuck his fingers in his ears and started singing Mary Had a Little Lamb at the top of his lungs.
"Tom?"
A quiet, sleepy voice interrupts from the hallway.
"Who's here so early?"
She cuts herself off with a yawn. Jim looks up.
There's a girl standing in the doorway wearing what looks to be like one of Tom's oversized t-shirts and nothing else.
Well, hello there, says Jim, grinning from ear to ear.
He turns to Tom in mock outrage.
Tom, I can't believe you never introduced me to your roommate.
Tom's face, or the half of it Jim can see anyway, is bright red.
Jim, Martha, Martha, Jim, he mumbles with a vague wave between the two of them.
Martha, Jim repeats, verbally molesting the name.
Jim, says Martha, bemused. She looks between the two of them. How do you know each other?
I usually refer to Jim as JT, Tom replies carefully,
and understanding dawns in Martha's expression, and Jim knows immediately that Tom told her about Tarsus. He fights down a wave of irrational irritation that he told her something so private, or maybe that Tom found someone with whom he can share something so private, when Jim never will. Jim manages to snap himself out of it in time to give Martha a pretty convincing grin.
I'm here to kill your boyfriend.
What did you do? She demands, immediately turning on Tom. Don't tell me you called him here for that, for what you showed me. Tom blushes and doesn't reply.
Tom, Martha says.
Forget it, Jim. I'm going to kill him myself.
I really thought it was him, Tom mumbles, face downcast and ashamed. I'm sorry, JT.
It's all right, Jim lies casually. Martha looks at the two of them and sighs. I guess no one's going back to sleep.
Probably not.
Jim and Tom say in unison. Well then, there should at least be coffee. Jim, can you help me in the kitchen? Tom lowers his voice to a stage whisper.
That's girl code for can I talk to you privately?
Uh-huh, says Jim, grinning crookedly to hide his unease. Sure, as long as that's a euphemism. Tom doesn't look perturbed by Jim's flirting in the slightest.
Have fun.
Yeah, these two are getting married. Jim follows Martha into the kitchen, where she actually starts making coffee. As far as Jim can tell, she's lost in thought, seeming unaware of the dead silence between them. Jim, on the other hand, shifts awkwardly for a while, then clears his throat and says,
Is it hot in here, or is it just me?
Martha looks up, amused, and Jim winces.
Sorry about that. I can't figure out how to turn it off.
This, of course, is when Martha decides to say, I'm worried about Tom.
Jim blurts, Can I open the window?
What? She says, distracted. Yeah, of course, but listen, Jim, it's been over 3 years, and he's still haunted daily by what you went through. Jim opens the window, closes his eyes, and breathes in the fresh air, trying to dispel the feeling of being trapped. The nighttime breeze cools his face, but not the jagged restlessness under his skin.
I'm not really qualified to give anyone advice, Martha.
Maybe, says Martha. But you don't see Governor Kodos everywhere, do you?
Sure I do, Jim thinks. Just not outside my own head.
I almost wish we could just find Kodos so Tom can finally lay the whole thing to rest.
Jim turns abruptly. Kodos is dead.
I know, JT, she says softly. I was only...
You don't get to call me JT, he snaps. You haven't earned that right.
She flinches and Jim sags. Pulls a hand through his hair and leans back on the windowsill.
Look, I'm sorry.
No, I'm sorry, Martha replies, wrapping her arms around herself, looking lost. I just wish I knew how to help him.
Jim laughs mirthlessly. I'm the last person who'd know. He's got skills, goals, an apartment, a girlfriend. He's doing pretty well, if you ask me.
You don't know the kind of dreams he has.
Jim doesn't reply.
She lowers her head in acknowledgement. Or maybe you do.
JT, Tom calls from the other room, his voice strained. Yeah? Do you happen to know why there's a stolen police car in the parking lot?
Ah, funny story, actually. That's when four officers burst into the kitchen, phasers drawn and fully decked out in protective gear, like Jim's got a hydrogen bomb or something.
Martha drops the coffee pot. Hands where we can see them, the front runner shouts.
A fifth officer enters with his phaser trained on Tom, who has his hands on his head.
Martha raises her own hands in surrender. Why are you here? The officer demands.
Jim smiles.
That's a pretty personal question.
Why are any of us here? Will we ever truly know?
Don't play stupid. Why did you come here? Are these your accomplices?
Jim's eyes flash to Tom's, and he remembers with a jolt that even one arrest for questioning will destroy any chance Tom has of getting into that PhD program he's been dreaming about. Just because Jim isn't going to amount to much of anything doesn't mean he's going to keep Tom from becoming something great.
Who? Those two? Yeah, right.
Jim glances at them dispassionately.
I've never seen them before today. Not the brightest folks, I can tell you that much. I just had to pretend I was stranded and asked to use their phone.
He sneers, letting himself believe his own lie for the moment.
They let me right in. Idiots. Too bad you came in before I could get anything of value off them. Well, that's a confession if I ever heard it, one of the officers mutters. If you give in now, we won't have to stun you.
Jim thinks about that.
Nah.
They stare at him in disbelief.
Nah?
I'm not really in the mood to get arrested tonight. See, I've been driving for 9 hours and I'm kind of beat. How about we split up, get a little shut-eye, and reconvene here tomorrow afternoon to pick up where we left off?
He's messing with us. Stun him.
Jim gives Tom and Martha a little salute, then sits back on the sill and flips backward out the window. Phaser fire ricochets off the kitchen wall where he'd just been. For a split second, he hangs from the ledge looking down, calculating the drop. Fourth floor apartment, about 45 to 50 feet minus 6 feet of his own height, probably won't break anything. And then he drops, landing in a crouch that sends shockwaves up into his knees, but, as he suspected, doesn't break anything. Jim can hear the officers yelling at each other from Tom's apartment. Unable to get through the window with their gear and unable to get a clear shot on Jim in the dark. He starts running, nowhere to hide, nowhere to go, just running and is promptly almost run over by a car whose driver sticks his head out of the window and yells, "Watch where you're going, moron! Are you crazy?" Jim licks his lips and leans forward and tries not to make it sound rushed. Like he's, let's say, being chased by 5 angry men with phasers, and replies, "A little bit. Are you?" By the time the squadron makes its way out of the apartment and down the stairs and out of the building and into the parking lot, Jim and his wonderful, thoughtful, unwitting getaway driver are long gone.
"He was quite short, wasn't he, Martha?" Tom muses when the police arrive to ask them to describe the beastly young man who'd broken into their apartment.
"Oh no, he was very tall, very tall."
"Maybe that was it. He had brown eyes, didn't he, and dark hair?"
"His eyes were green, Tom," she replies, "and he was wearing a hat."
"Or was it a turban?"
"Well, it was made of wool, like a ski cap turban."
Tom nods. "Right, that's exactly how I would describe it, a ski cap turban."
The police officer, meanwhile, is jotting down notes only to have to cross them out again and visibly attempting to rein in her temper. "Do you remember anything for certain about the trespasser?" she asks between gritted teeth. "That facial hair," Martha says immediately. "Right, Tom?"
"That's right," says Tom. "He had this enormous goatee."
"Enormous," Martha agrees, nodding.
"It was just huge and long and, massive."
Martha tilts her head, considering. "Or was he clean-shaven?"
"You know what? You're right. He might have been clean-shaven."
"I'm pretty sure he was clean-shaven."
"Like a bald monkey," Tom agrees, nodding.
"So clean-shaven, in fact," says Martha thoughtfully. "Are we sure he was male?"
The police officer actually puts down her notepad so she can bang her head repeatedly on the kitchen cabinet.
Eventually, the police get the far more reliable testimony of the officers who'd come to help Tom and Martha, and Jim is found and brought up on charges of Grand Theft Auto and impersonation of an officer of the law. Tom drops the attempted robbery charge. What are friends for, after all? This time, when Jim is convicted, he's too old for juvie. Jim learns quickly that things work differently in jail than they did in juvenile detention. In juvie, as much as nobody is willing to admit it, everyone is lonely, and everyone is messed up, and everyone is looking for friends, for a family, even if the desire to belong is buried under a light year's worth of baggage. By the time these kids get to jail, they've gotten used to being alone. They don't need or want a family. In juvie, Jim was one of the older kids. Now he's one of the youngest. He does okay, though. He's known for years that there's no such thing as a free lunch, no such thing as free anything, including friendship, safety, food. Everyone has their own commodities to give, and everyone wants something in return for what they have, and jail is no different. It's just more straightforward. Jim still only has one commodity to offer. In juvie, they're told all day that they can make themselves into something great regardless of their history. In jail, they're told they're the scum of the earth, like they've already lost their chance. And like Gatsby, in both cases, the inmates become who they are expected to be. In jail, Jim's cellmate is 10 years older and 50 pounds heavier than Nick, and an actual murderer. Jail is better than juvie in one way, though. He actually gets calls, mainly from Tom. The first one is just a string of sorry, 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 until Jim couldn't take it anymore and hung up. The rest were better. About Jim teaching martial arts class to the inmates, about Tom's PhD program, about anything other than Tarsus. He even gets a call from his mother. He's near the end of his sentence, and she's fresh off the starship from her 5-year mission, only to discover that Frank was cheating on her. What a shock. Jim is shocked. Exclamation points. Jim's not a complete jerk, though, so he tries to muster some melancholy when his mom tells him she's getting a divorce. Aw, that's a shame. I'm sorry, Mom. She gives a faint laugh. No, you aren't. You never liked him. Sam never liked him either, Jim volunteers. Yes, he did. Sam and Frank always got along. No way, says Jim. Sam was just better at hiding it. Sam was better than us at a lot of things, she says quietly. Kinda sucked at not dying, though, Jim points out. His mother finds a reason to hang up shortly thereafter. He doesn't blame her. He doesn't even bother getting excited to leave jail this time. He knows he'll just end up in the same wandering cycle he'd been in before, bouncing around from place to place, from bed to bed. He sits on the jailhouse stairs and stares up at the sky for hours. He celebrates his freedom at his favorite riverside bar, where he orders a drink in every color of the rainbow on money he doesn't have. And the girl next to him, Jessica, he learns later, takes one look at the selection in front of him and says, "Expecting a party?" "Party of one," says Jim. He flashes her a flirtatious smile. "Unless you want to join me." "Put all that alcohol into your system and you could actually die. 'Tis a consummation devoutly to be wished." "Seriously, though, you're not actually going to drink all that. I dare you to even try." Jim tilts his head and raises an eyebrow. Jim doesn't die. He still doesn't know how to feel about that. A few years and many more odd jobs later, bartending, construction, more mechanics' garages, he even plays guitar on the street for a while. Jim is older and maybe wiser and has an impressively multifaceted skill set for his resume, but is still equally broke, which brings him to the rest stop just a few miles from Riverside, where he's just gotten a free pack of cigarettes from the girl behind the counter by flirting with her. Not that he was particularly opposed to the idea of going down on her for it. She was cute. Sex, like money, never stays in Jim's pants for long. Luckily, sex, unlike money, is one commodity of which Jim has plenty to spare. Partly because he keeps getting mugged. He's not even a full block away from the rest stop when he feels something small and hard pressed between his shoulder blades. "Don't turn around. Just empty your pockets and put everything on the ground and no one has to get hurt." He pauses, hears the faint tremor in her voice, and knows she doesn't have a phaser. He turns around. "What did I just say?" The girl snaps, but she's already retreating, the handle of a hairbrush still pointed in his direction. He wonders how much she's gotten by holding people up at hairbrush point. "When you mess with people on the street, you have to deal with people on the street," he says, crossing his arms. "One day you're going to try to mug someone who actually has a weapon." "If I live that long," she replies. He looks closer, at the familiar look in her eyes, the desperation hardened into a sort of bitter humor, caring only about surviving until the next meal. That's also when he sees a younger girl peeking around the corner behind her, about 10 or 11 years old. She has the girl's brown hair and hazel eyes.
You leave her alone, his would-be mugger hisses, getting into a fighting stance. You have a problem with me, you deal with me, you hear? Leave her alone. Jim puts his hands up in surrender. Okay, okay. You've scared me into submission. He pulls out his wallet, whatever's left in it, and pocket pad and puts them on the ground. Then he takes out his keys and holds them up. These are for apartment 3A on the corner of 53rd and Lafayette. The fridge has some stuff in it, and the rent's paid through the end of the month. Then you're on your own. Don't do anything stupid for it. Your sister needs you. She doesn't reply for a long time, watching him suspiciously. At last, she says, "Are you going to be there?" They both know what she's really asking. He swallows at the dry, easy way she says it, because of course everyone wants something in return. "No," he says. He bends, puts the keys on the ground next to his wallet and pocket pad. "That's my only set of keys," he lies. "I'm heading elsewhere." She watches him for a while, then darts forward, grabs the stuff, and is off around the corner before Jim can think better of it. "Well," Jim mutters, "that wasn't the smartest thing I've ever done. Not the stupidest thing either, to be fair. Not that that's saying much in his case." Night has properly fallen at this point, and Jim shivers, rubs his arms. He checks his pockets to do inventory of whatever he has left. Let's see. Fake ID, spare keys, a couple of condoms, a lighter, some wire. Hey, his free pack of cigarettes! So, with nowhere to go and no way to get there, he sits himself down on the curb and pulls out a cigarette. Jim takes a long drag and leans back on his hands, breathing the smoke out and looking up at those gorgeous, lonely stars, and thinking of Tom. Tom, who's halfway through his research program. Tom, who just got engaged to Martha, the love of his life. Jim privately thinks 22 is a few millennia too young to be settling down, but then they've always kind of been too young, and that's never stopped anything from happening before. Jim intends to go to the wedding so he can give Tom a hug and a congratulations on not letting Tarsus screw you over, and have some crazy monkey sex, and drink himself blind, not necessarily in that order. He intends to go to that wedding so he can have one night of pretending that maybe someday he'll be like that too, moving on with his life, finding love and purpose and happiness, leaving the experience behind him, like Martha and good old Dr. Mel wanted. In the meantime, Jim has a different theory of moving on, and it's been treating him just fine so far. It goes like this. Someday, Kodos won't matter anymore because he'll have slept with everyone and everything else. Why not Kodos too? After all, there is no such thing as the one, probably. At least, no such thing exists for Jim. Or maybe he's already banged them. One of the many nameless stepping stones Jim's used to get where he is. That is, penniless and shivering and alone in the dark on a deserted curb in the middle of nowhere, Iowa. Jim thinks about how Tom looks at Martha, how Mom must have looked at Dad, how Sam looked at Erica. God. Jim's laugh plumes in the cold air. If you could only see me now, Sam. No way would Sam have let himself get shot for Jim if he'd known where his little brother would end up. He was too smart for that. That was the problem, really. So wise, so young, they say, do never live long. Then all you've got left is the stupid, human, still-not-dead kids like Jim. He huffs another quiet breath, rubs his cigarette out on the pavement, and picks himself up off the curb. He sticks his hands in his pockets for whatever warmth they can offer him, content to let his one goal be, for the moment. Let's wander down this here street for a bit, see where it takes us. For all the good it does him, Jim sometimes entertains these ideas about the future that grow more and more bizarre as they go on. That maybe one day he'll stop drinking, stop smoking, stop borrowing motor vehicles, stop getting into fights, stop sleeping around, stop driving too fast, start getting back in touch with his mother, start seeing a therapist, start getting 8 hours of sleep a night and eating nothing but salad. Yeah. But hey, weirder things have happened. Maybe one day he'll go straight.
In the meantime, Jim catches sight of the sexiest little motorcycle in the skimpiest little security system he'd ever laid eyes on, and slows to give a low whistle and a very thorough once-over. "Hello, gorgeous," he murmurs, running his fingers over the perfect black coat and feeling the sleek, powerful body underneath. He moans quietly in appreciation. "Fierce woman like you. I wonder if you've ever had a man who could treat you right." Well, she sure does now. As Jim suspected, she rides like a dream, and soon enough he's back at his favorite dive in Riverside, eyeing up the other customers and ordering drinks he doesn't have the credits for. Izzy's manning the bar tonight, and he really should know better than to give him anything. But he seems to know that Jim needs to be drunk right now, and cuts him a break. He sits back to appreciate his Jack Daniels and thinks briefly of the stolen motorcycle parked outside. He probably has about 24 more hours to pawn it off on some gullible schlub before the owner realizes it's gone. He'll have to give them the other keys to the apartment so they don't realize it's hotwired and report Jim right away. No big deal. So he sits there for a few hours, getting drink after drink and scoping out the clientele, until he catches sight of a stunner in a Starfleet uniform, cadet, ordering about a billion drinks. "That's a lot of drinks for one woman," he comments, leaning forward to ogle her properly. She ignores him. "And a shot of Jack, straight up," she adds to Izzy. "Make that two," he tells Izzy. "Her shot's on me." Izzy gives him a look that clearly says he knows very well that Jim can't even pay for his own drinks, let alone hers, but thankfully doesn't say anything. "Her shot's on her. Thanks, but no thanks," she says to Jim with a patronizing smile. "Ah, playing hard to get. Just his type. Don't you want to at least know my name before you completely reject me?" "I'm fine without it." He grins. Too easy. "You are fine without it," he agrees. "It's Jim. Jim Kirk." Then he looks at her expectantly. She doesn't reply. "If you don't tell me your name, I'm going to have to make one up," he warns her. And boy, does she not want that. This one looks like a Theodosia. She looks up, trying not to laugh. "It's Uhura," she says at last. "Uhura? No way! That's the name I was going to make up for you. Uhura what?" "Just Uhura." "They don't have last names in your world?" "Uhura is my last name," she says. "Well, they don't have..." It takes a minute for his plastered brain to come up with the word he's looking for. First names in your world?" She laughs and shakes her head, and Jim knows he's got her. He grabs his drink and heads over to lean on the counter next to her. "So," he says, "you're a cadet, you're stunning, what's your focus?" "Xenolinguistics," she replies, all prim and scientific-like. "Rarr." "You have no idea what that means." "Study of alien languages, morphology, phonology, syntax," he says. She looks up at him properly for the first time, surprised. "It means you've got a talented tongue." She smiles that smile, and yep, he's definitely got her. "I'm impressed. For a moment, I thought you were just a dumb hick who only had sex with farm animals." "Well," he says, "not only." And she laughs for real. Which is obviously when some other cadet, this big, meaty dude, comes up and says, "This townie isn't bothering you, right?" And the thing is, it's so obvious he isn't bothering her. She's laughing, she's looking up at him through her eyelashes, that the insinuation really shouldn't bother him, but the very idea that Jim would pursue someone that didn't want to be pursued, that he's trying to coerce her into something she doesn't want, that he's insisting even though she's saying no, it raises his hackles like nothing else, and he has to forcibly keep himself from responding. "Oh, beyond belief," she laughs, "but it's nothing I can't handle." She raises her eyebrows at Jim in playful challenge at this part, and Jim leans in closer. "You could handle me. That's an invitation." "Hey," the other cadet says angrily, probably has a crush on Uhura. Who can blame him?
You better mind your manners.
He should let Uhura get rid of the guy. He knows nothing about Kodos. He knows nothing about how terrified Jim is that he really will become the sort of person who makes people into what he wants them to be. Jim really shouldn't let it get to him. He really shouldn't.
It does get to him.
Oh, relax, Cupcake, Kiss says, slapping the guy on the shoulder.
It was a joke.
He says it as much to reassure himself as to refute Cupcake.
It was. Who would have noticed if she was saying no? Wouldn't he?
He turns back to Uhura, tries to clear his mind of everything, only to be pulled back by Cupcake.
Hey, farm boy, maybe you can't count? There are four of us and one of you. So get some more guys, and then it'll be a fair fight, he says.
Then gives Cupcake a condescending little smile and pats him on the cheek. He sees the fist heading toward him, but doesn't have time to stop it.
Well, that wasn't the smartest thing I've ever done, Jim thinks, groaning as he attempts to roll his bleeding, piss-drunk body off the bar table. Not the stupidest thing either, to be fair. Not that that's saying much. The man who'd called off those Starfleet thugs had disappeared to do something. For lack of an actual name, Jim decides to call him Captain Von Trapp. The captain, going by his uniform, with the fearsome whistle of ultimate domination. Eventually, he manages to get himself upright in a chair and strips off his jacket and sticks some napkins in his nose to stop the bleeding. Not the most attractive option, but plenty effective. Captain Von Trapp comes back and takes the seat across from Jim.
I've had them charge the repairs to my credit chip, as well as all those drinks you ordered and the money you don't have.
This is true enough. Jim did not, in fact, have the money for those drinks. How nice of the good captain to take care of the bill for him. How generous, etc. More importantly, what does he want in exchange? The man takes something out of his pocket.
Does this look familiar?
Jim takes it, turns it around. It's a USS Kelvin salt shaker.
Classy.
It's a really lame Happy Meal toy?
Look, it's leaking. Captain Von Trapp looks hard at Jim, then just shakes his head.
Okay, you're right. Stupid question. Stupid answer.
Do you, like, carry these things around with you? Jim asks.
So that if you meet someone and you want to shut them up, you can give them a little Starship salt shaker to play with?
Also, does that actually work? Because if so, I want a dozen little Starships, please.
The captain glances at him, with what might be amusement.
It hasn't worked with you yet, has it? Christopher Pike, by the way.
Jim doesn't bother giving his own name. Isn't even sure the man wants it. Instead, he just lifts his glass in acknowledgement and takes a swig of beer, using the opportunity to discreetly observe his new buddy. His first guess would be a member of the George Kirk fan club, but since he hasn't tried to berate Jim for his reckless, drunken, delinquent behavior, and in fact paid for the damages caused by Jim's reckless, drunken, delinquent behavior, Jim's going to go with Sugar Daddy. And far be it from Jim to turn down a Sugar Daddy. He's a little bit older than Jim's usual benefactors, but not bad-looking. Pretty in shape, an officer, and a captain, no less. He's probably cheating on his wife. Why Jim's caught his attention, blood on his shirt and napkins up his nose and all, is its own mystery. But hey, Jim's not complaining. He can milk this guy for all he's worth.
Financially speaking.
I'm not the sort of guy to beat around the bush. My rate's 400 credits a night, or 150 for an hour. You up for it?
Your rate?
Pike repeats, baffled. A sort of dismayed understanding dawns in his expression.
I'm married.
Jim gives a little drunken wave.
We both know that doesn't mean anything.
Pike looks at him, incredulous, then shakes his head.
You know, I couldn't believe it when the bartender told me who you are.
All right, which of Jim's many identities is he addressing here? Jimmy? JT? Jay? Jim? Nameless guy ready for some no-strings-attached fun. He's hoping for the last one, personally, so he gives a crooked little grin and says, And who am I, Captain Pike? He gets a look for that, so he didn't miss the fact that he never actually told Jim his rank.
Your father's son.
Huh. So he's addressing George Kirk Jr.
Wonderful. Not a customer or a friend, just another admirer, well-meaning wannabe father figure. Should have gone with his gut and run away when he first saw the Kelvin salt shaker.
Oh well, might as well get a refill on this guy's tab, if he has to endure yet another episode of What I Love About Your Father.
For my dissertation, I was assigned the USS Kelvin, Pike tells him, and Jim braces himself for the inevitable adoring comment like what immediately follows, which is, something I admired about your dad. He didn't believe in no-win scenarios.
Jim pulls the napkins out of his nose.
Gross.
Sure learned his lesson, he mutters. Ironically, being forced into corners with no good escape route is something, possibly the only thing, he and his dad actually do have in common. The day George Kirk died was the day James Kirk was born, and the last lesson that his father learned was the first one Jim learned. The immutability of no-win scenarios. Jim knows full well that sometimes you sacrifice everything for someone you love. And then he goes and gets himself shot anyway.
Well, it depends on how you define winning, Pike says. You're here, aren't you?
It is primarily because of pep talks like this that Jim has begun to think of George Kirk as, essentially, his own personal Jesus. Why should you love him if you never knew him? Because he loved you, of course. Well, yes, he didn't actually know you, but he did die for you after all. Isn't that the greatest display of affection? Oh, you have no idea, Jimmy. He was so kind and brave. So handsome, too. Pretty much as perfect as any human can be. Why can't you be more like your father, Jimmy? Your father would never dream of doing something like that, Jimmy. Your father died for your sins, Jimmy. Why aren't you worshipping him like the rest of us? Jim is all too familiar with this species of Kirk admirer. The ones who think that all Jim really needs to do is stop and wonder, what would George do? And then he'll turn out all right. He's also learned that the best way to deal with them is to accept the free beer and settle in for the long haul. Except the hero worship doesn't come.
You know, that instinct to leap before looking? That was in his nature too. And in my opinion, something Starfleet's lost.
Okay, now Jim has no idea what this man wants from him. He doesn't want sex. He doesn't want to tell Jim how great his dad was. Well, he does, but not predominantly. And Jim doesn't have the patience to figure it out. Everyone wants something, of course. The sooner you know what that something is, the better. Especially since the good captain here is trying to butter him up. Never a good sign. He gives a short, bitter laugh and cuts to the chase.
Why are you talking to me, man? Because I looked up your file while you were drooling on the floor.
Jim raises his eyebrows back, waiting for him to get to the point.
Your aptitude tests.
Ah, goody. So this is the I'm worried about you, Jim, conversation. His favorite.
Are off the charts, so what is it? You like being the only genius-level repeat offender in the Midwest?
Maybe I love it, Jim replies. Pike frowns.
So your dad dies. You can settle for a less than ordinary life, but you feel like you were meant for something better. Something special.
Yeah, all right. Jim used to feel like that. Like he was some special little snowflake waiting for the moment he'd be recognized and pulled out of a world of ordinary people to follow some special snowflake destiny. Doesn't everyone believe that at some point? But it doesn't matter what he used to think, what kind of life he thought he could have. This was the life he has, and God knows he's tried hard enough to rid himself of it.
Enlist in Starfleet, Pike says.
Is that where all that talk was going? Jim can't help but laugh.
You guys must be way down in your recruiting quota for the month. If you're half the man your father was, Jim, Starfleet could use you.
Anyone could use me, Jim thinks. Anyone will, if I let them.
You could be an officer in 4 years, Pike is saying, like he's trying to sell Jim a car or something. You could have your own ship in 8.
Then he launches into some kind of explanation of what the Federation does, and yep, that's the end of Jim's ability to endure people assuming he's a stupid delinquent. He's not a stupid delinquent. He's a highly intelligent delinquent, thank you very much.
We done?
There's a pause.
I'm done, says Pike.
Thank God. He can go back to his drink, go back to what he was doing before, go back to telling everyone to leave him alone, when all he's thinking is, help me, help me, help me. Pike gets to his feet, but he doesn't leave.
Riverside Shipyard. Shuttle for new recruits leaves tomorrow at 0800.
Jim makes a cheers motion with his glass.
Pike still doesn't leave.
Instead, he says,
"You know, your father was a captain of a starship for 12 minutes.
You know, they're never done when they say they're done.
He saved 800 lives, including your mother's and yours."
Jim almost snorts at that.
He was his father's idea of a winning situation.
Apparently, Pike's trying to say that it was worth it for his dad to sacrifice everything because Jim is still here and if Jim keeps doing what he's been doing since he was 15, driving himself into the ground, trying indirectly to get himself killed, he'll be doing to George exactly what Sam did to him. Destroying everything the sacrifice was made for in the first place. Creating a no-win scenario.
Huh.
Maybe he and his father really do have something in common after all.
"I dare you to do better," Pike says.
Then he turns and leaves the bar without looking back. Jim tilts his head and raises an eyebrow.